Chancellor, Professor Layton, ladies and gentlemen. When I got the invitation to deliver this lecture, I looked at the list of previous speakers, and I thought, this is truly a privilege to be asked to deliver a lecture in this series. And maybe I didn't take 2 years, but I did decide fairly soon that I would, in fact, do it. The particular privilege and honor is also not just the lecture, but the person after whom it is named. We today, many of us in my generation, grew up having rather cursorily read the works of Dr. Ambedkar. And over the years, and particularly in recent times, we've taken to reading them much more carefully and discovering, in fact, really a rather giant of a man in terms of his thought, as planning for Indian society. And therefore, I feel that, in fact, the honor is very, very great to be asked to say something in memory of a person of his stature. I chose this subject partly because in recent years civilization has been bothering me, and partly because I think that the study of history has kind of moved on beyond the study of civilizations, and therefore I would like to put some of these ideas before you to think about them. I would like to begin by clarifying that in this lecture I'm looking at the concept of civilization as it has been used in reconstructing world histories. The term has had philosophical and other connotations that introduce other dimensions other than the historical. But I am, however, confining myself to the historical perspective. The history of the world from pre-modern times has, in recent centuries, been projected in the form of stages, some culminating in civilizations. However, in the light of recent studies of history, civilization, as earlier defined, is becoming rather paradoxical. The concept is a construction that emerged at a particular point in history. It was a way of comprehending the past. Other ways now emerging may lead us to rethink the concept. So what was meant by a civilization? A civilization implied a kind of package with specific characteristics. Thus, the territory of a civilization has to be demarcated. Civilization is identified with a period of high intellectual and aesthetic achievement, what some would call high culture, including an emphasis on humanism and ethics. Associated with this is a premium on refined manners exemplified by the elite. I suppose the nearest equivalent we would have of it would be nazakat. Civilization is articulated in a particular parent language. It is symbolized in a single religion. It assumes a stratified society, evidence of a state and governance. Its elite is distinctive and dominates its surroundings. There is a marked presence of what is described as aspects of culture, art, monuments, literature, music, all of a sophisticated form. And above all, a civilization records its knowledge of the world and attempts to advance it. You would think this definition covers everything, but I'm going to try and argue that perhaps there are important aspects that have got left out. I have 2 concerns in this lecture. One is that a civilization draws on the identities of its creators and its participants, but The identities of both change in the course of history. And secondly, that concepts help us to understand social reality, but they in turn have to be investigated, and more so where they claim to be foundational to understanding history. The somewhat spare definition that I have just given needs enlargement. The territory is expansive, resulting from the ultimate success of one from amongst a number of competing others. The dominant culture monopolizes the constituents of civilization to the near exclusion of the lesser cultures that then tend to be sidelined. Change is endemic to most societies, either from within or from contact with other societies. This can disturb the social equilibrium, resulting in either increasing or decreasing the integration of its various units. A civilization, therefore, cannot be static, as its constituents inevitably change. Let me now begin with how and when the concept of civilization first came to be constructed. Used in France in the 18th century, the concept assumed a departure from a prior condition. The Enlightenment understanding of history, together with social Darwinism in the subsequent period, placed human society in an advanced evolutionary stage. It underlined humanistic values as embedded in the literature, and the belief that rational beings could control the world around them. German writers differentiated between civilization and what they called Kultur, culture. Culture referred to what was thought of as intellectual and artistic in terms of values and ideals, and to morality. Cultures, again, were not compact, enclosed, and static. Civilization, however, had a broader spread and included more, as the definition suggests. Was this, I've often thought, a middle-class culture searching for self-expression? Civilization assumed that the historically preceding societies did not qualify. These were labeled as barbarian. This dichotomy was present in the self-perception of ancient societies, but with a different connotation. Those regarded as the others were assumed to be uncivilized. For the Greeks, it was the non-Greeks. For the Chinese, the non-Han. And for the Aryas, it was the Mlech. If the Greeks called them barbaros, barbarians, Sanskrit speakers referred to them as barabara karoti, speaking in a confused way. The barbarians, irrespective of whether they lived as nomadic hordes threatening the civilized, or even among the civilized, were recognizable by their markers, difference of language and custom. The concept of civilization assumed the existence of the barbarian as a kind of all-purpose counterpoint to the civilized. In other words, the civilized always had to have the other. In the 19th century, the dichotomy was further elaborated. Human society was said to go through three stages of change. Starting with savagery, it improved somewhat when it reached barbarism, and this was prior to civilization. So the three stages were savagery, barbarism, and civilization. Only some societies evolved to the third stage. It was thought of essentially as a process of evolution, and remember this is post-Darwin, and used to point up the distinction between the stages. The other more effective route was seen in the imposition of the civilized on the barbarian through conquest. an obvious attempt to justify contemporary colonialism. A classic example of this that was quoted always was that the Aztecs of Mexico, being less civilized, performed human sacrifice. In fact, they were barbarians. And the civilized Spanish conquest brought it to an end. This has been broadly discussed today in Latin American historical circles, taking a very different position. The concept was now used in two ways. One was its role in colonial thinking, and the other was the appropriation of social evolution into theories of explanation in anthropology, archaeology, and history. Let's turn first to colonial thinking. Colonial thinking was clear about the distinction between the civilized and its alternate, the primitive. The colonizer, as the representative of a superior civilization, introduced it to the colonized, the uncivilized primitive. In India, two divergent views, the utilitarian and the orientalist, emerged from colonial writers. James Mill and the utilitarian thinkers, writing on the Indian past, saw the territory of India as hosting two nations, the Hindu and the Muslim, each intensely hostile to the other. However, its governance conformed to what was called Oriental despotism, pointing to the absence of a civilized society. The colonized, therefore, required correction in order to be civilized. The Orientalist view was somewhat different. It began with William Jones in the late 18th century, inquiring of the learned Brahmins as to the texts he should study in order to understand India. He was directed to the Vedas and classical Sanskrit literature. Significantly, the Buddhist and the Jain texts were largely ignored. Jones's comparative studies of language and religion were a search for parallels to the Greco-Roman language and religion. The Orientalists and the Sanskritists in Europe disagreed with the utilitarians. They argued that India did have a civilization and that it needed to be recognized. Influential amongst them was, of course, Max Müller, who focused on the Vedic corpus, especially the Rig Veda. Such studies led to the theory that the Vedas were the foundation of Indian civilization, and that this civilization reached its crowning point in the golden age of the Guptas, extending into a few centuries later. Seeing India as a single unitary civilization, specifically defined, made it easier for the colonizers to understand the colony, irrespective of how problematic these definitions were and were to become. We today have inherited these colonial views about religion, language, and history, and we're still grappling with them. Dividing the world into civilizations provided portals to the study of global history. Association with a single language and preferably a single religion meant that each civilization could be more easily monitored as compared to a non-structured history. Asia, it was said, could boast of three civilizations: the Islamic, with Arabic as its language, the Sanskritic Hindu, and the Chinese associated with Confucianism. I've often asked myself as to why Buddhism was lost sight of in this typology. Buddhism was once the interconnecting thread through most of Asia. It was made to disappear in India, it faded in Central Asia, and it was on occasion actively persecuted in China. Yet, it emerged as a crucial Asian link in civilizational markers and ethical values. A deeper investigation of the critique transposed by Buddhist thought to many existing Asian cultures may help us redefine some aspects of Asian civilizations. However, the concept of civilization, when associated with anthropology and archaeology, took a different turn. Patterns in the development of human societies drew from the theory of evolution. And I'm now talking about the late 19th, the early 20th century. Moving as a trajectory from simple societies to complex societies. It was held that human society began with the stage of savagery in the bands of hunter-gatherers. Subsequently, there were societies of agro-pastoralists. Many took shape as highly efficient herders of animals, especially cattle and horses, and in the systems of cultivating crops. The institution of family and notions of property that radically changed society emerged, but very slowly. This took them to the stage of barbarism that was extensive and diverse. They were identified by the typology of the material goods they produced, such as pottery and metalwork. Some remained at that stage, others moved to the third and highest stage, that of urbanism, which became civilization. As in the case of animal life, evolution did not move in a vertical line for all societies. For some, a horizontal movement became permanent. Those not recognized as civilizations were then described as cultures, the smaller units within the civilizations. A culture was defined as a pattern of living. Please note the difference between the 19th century German definition, which talks about intellectual achievement. Now, anthropologically and archaeology, culture is defined as a pattern of living, so everybody has a culture. And there could be many cultures encompassed in a civilization, whereas a civilization was defined by selective features. The primary features of the civilizational stage were urban centers, literacy, and the existence of a state. Therefore, high culture alone did not suffice. This archaeological, anthropological trajectory, formulated in the early 20th century, has lately been extensively debated. The critique has suggested alternate ideas, but has not totally annulled the theory. It has, however, been problematic in a few instances where earlier definitions of civilization were already in use, as, for example, in India. What do we do with the two definitions? According to the archaeological definition, the Harappan cities are the foundations of India's civilization. These predate the generally accepted date of Vedic culture by quite a few centuries. There is so far little evidence of these cities conforming in essentials to what is described as Aryan culture. For some of the Orientalists, it was Vedic culture that was foundational to Indian civilization, the Harappan cities not having been discovered till the early 20th century. But this culture lacked some of the fundamental components of the civilizational stage, as for example, urbanization and literacy. Harappan cities were not only elaborate urban systems, but were carefully planned by people who understood the working of urban centers. The location of public functioning was concentrated on an artificially constructed mound and was distinct from the expansive residential adjoining area. Other features of the Harappan cities are, of course, very familiar to us from our school textbooks. A sensible layout with planned roads, a remarkable drainage system, warehouses and granaries, and complicated defenses at the city gates. Among the other aspects of an advanced culture was the central role of a system of writing. We now have a somewhat contrary situation where archaeology informs us that the foundations of Indian civilization lie in the pre-Vedic cities of the Indus civilization. But the Orientalists of half a century earlier had projected the Vedas as the foundation, and this continues to be preferred in some circles today. There is a significant difference between the two. Whereas texts are absent in the Harappan culture, even though a writing system is in use and widespread use, the Vedic corpus boasts of oral compositions of a high order composed over a millennium, but has left no evidence of a writing system or urbanization. Inevitably, there are controversies today about the origins of Indian civilization. The concept of civilization, popular amongst 19th century historians, was of course not the archaeological one, since that was worked out only in the early 20th century. Yet it is to the 19th century definition that we go more often these days, and very many people think of the civilization, and Indian civilization in particular, in terms of the 19th century definition. I would therefore like to discuss the definition of Indian civilization that has prevailed in many works on the subject since the 19th century. The territory chosen was that of British India. The confidence of colonialism made it seem that it would be permanent and stable. Earlier names for bits and parts of the subcontinent, such as Jambudvipa, Aryavarta, Bharatvarsha, or even Al-Hind, had shifting boundaries. But even British India, as we know, broke up into three nations in the 20th century. This was not unusual, as every century has seen changing alignments in the borders of the many states and kingdoms comprising the subcontinent. If there's one thing that is for sure, there were no permanent boundaries in history. In pre-cartographic times, prior to the 15th, 16th centuries, defining boundaries with any precision was problematic in the absence of maps. The more common usage was that of frontier zones, marked by geomorphological features. Forests, rivers, mountains, and so on were the boundary markers. A study of such frontier zones suggests that sometimes much the more interesting historical interactions took place in such zones. Frontier zones had the advantage of looking both inwards and outwards. They even had the choice of deciding which was which. For a variety of reasons, the geographical focus of high cultures shifted. The Harappans occupied the Indus Plain and its extension, but their artifacts are found as far west as the Gulf and Mesopotamia. The authors of the Vedic texts settled in the Punjab and the northwestern borderlands moved eastwards into the Ganga Plain. The second urbanization had its epicenter in the middle Ganga Plain. In many general histories of India, the peninsula and the south tend to be somewhat off the radar at this point, probably because the archaeology of their impressive megalithic cultures differed from the cultures of northern India, as also did the Dravidian language associated with that area. But speaking of frontiers and from the subcontinental perspective, the Kushans, for example, were half in and half out. Their fulcrum was the Oxus Valley. We may well treat them as integrated into North Indian history as we do, But it would be worth asking whether they, in effect, may have looked upon northwestern India as a frontier zone of their own Central Asian kingdom. And if so, how did they see it? Did Kushana polity focus more on Central Asia and China? Indian texts have less to say about the Kushans, but they are a presence in the Chinese annals of the time, the Hohan Shu. Indian writings of early times lacks curiosity about frontiers and beyond, as compared, for instance, with the Chinese inquisitiveness on this subject. In the control of territory within India, the Guptas and the Cholas were virtually mirror images in terms of the area of territory they controlled. One had a northern perspective and the other a southern one. The Turks, Afghans and Mughals, irrespective of their origins, were firmly ensconced in northern India. Interestingly, the Mauryan and the Mughal states had similar boundaries, incorporating the northwest borderlands, but not controlling the southernmost areas. Territorially, neither of them made it to being a fully subcontinental empire. But these days, identifying people with territory has become very complicated with the frequent inputs of those working on DNA analysis to determine migrations and the mixing of populations. So in terms of the territorial base of the civilization, we are not speaking of a compact subcontinental area, but of parts of it that hosted a variety of cultures. The variations are pertinent to the notion of constructing a civilization, but these are frequently ignored when selections are made of what goes into a civilizational package. And the same is true of West Asia and China, it's not just India. What this suggests is that we should be sensitive to changes in the frontier areas, both overland and maritime. We should be open to how they may have contributed to the creation of what we call civilization as pertinent to some areas. The view from the other side cannot be overlooked, as we have repeatedly done. It is interesting that there was such a substantial interest in Buddhism amongst Chinese scholars, but comparatively much less in Brahmanism, if, as we like to believe, that the latter was central to Indian civilization. At the same time, cultures within themselves also evolve over time. This makes it necessary to see civilization not as a permanent entity, but as a continuous process also registering historical change. Language is often a good barometer of historical change. We know that all languages mutate. Given the array of Indian languages, the change was impressive, both through mutation and through contact with other languages. This poses a couple of problems, questions for a historian. One is that we don't know as yet what language the Harappans spoke. Attempts to read the Harappan symbols as Indo-Aryan or Dravidian have so far not succeeded. The Vedic corpus refers to the Lecha and the Dasas as different from the Aryans. They either spoke the Aryan language incorrectly or did not speak it at all. There is also the puzzling group referred to as the Dasi Putra Brahmans, something of an oxymoron. Can the sons of Dasis be Brahmins? But there they are, and respected by Brahmins. It seems that more than one language was being spoken, and more than one cultural group was involved in what we may call the foundations of Indian civilization. But let's leave that aside. It's still inexplicable. And let's turn to certainties. For almost a millennium, the language most widely used was not Sanskrit, but Prakrit, although both coexisted. The Jaina texts were initially composed in Prakrit. The Buddhist texts were all composed in Pali. Discussions on causality in thought, dharma, ahimsa, rationality, the existence of deity, and ideas such as such ideas were discussed by a number of people, probably in Prakrit. The evidence of inscriptions points to Prakrit being the initial commonly used language, even by royalty, and Tamil in the south. An early inscription, possibly the earliest, in correct Sanskrit, dates to 150 AD, with a lengthy statement by a ruler of Central Asian origin. Prakrit, in turn, traveled to Central Asia, Southeast Asia, and the trading centers of the Red Sea. Learned Brahmins continued to use Sanskrit, but its use on a larger scale, or the emergence of what has recently been called the Sanskrit cosmopolis, so named by Sheldon Pollock, much in the news lately, dates to the later period from the Guptas onwards. This was when it came to have a monopoly as the language of learning, creative literature, administration, and was used by all those aspiring to status. It expanded further with courtly culture in newly established kingdoms. This required its use by local court poets, which was done, also in official documents, where occasionally the scribe could even make a few mistakes. However, in Sanskrit Brahma, women and lower castes continued to speak Prakrit, presumably as befitting their inferior social status. Newly established kingdoms, when hard-pressed, would use the emerging regional languages, especially when new castes of local origin became upwardly mobile. Sanskrit was preeminent for a millennium in virtually every branch of learning, and more so in courtly literature and in religious scholarship, composed more frequently by upper caste authors. The history of this prior patronage explains in part its high status at the Mughal court. Patronage to Sanskrit in medieval times as one of the languages of learning and formal religion is borne out by the numbers of literary texts, commentaries, digests that were composed in the last 1,000 years under multiple patrons. This continued with patronage from the colonial state, conscious of the upper caste connections of Sanskrit. The literatures in other languages received less attention as carriers of civilization. It might be worth doing a survey of what was composed in these languages throughout history to gauge the lineages of thought and articulation. And this in itself would be insightful in evaluating the role of the single language as a civilizational input. Any text of any kind and in whatever language assumes an audience. All composition is in essence a dialogue. If a text is written by the elite and uses the language of the elite, it reflects the elite culture and can at best only indirectly reflect the participation of other cultures. To that extent, using a single language curtails our understanding of the civilization. Much the same can be said about choosing a particular religion as the single one to represent a civilization. The colonial readings of religions in India describe them as monolithic. But were they so? Most colonial scholars saw Indian religions through their experience from the medieval European past, with its single monolithic religion of Catholicism and later of Protestantism. It is debatable whether religions in India were monolithic and unitary. Virtually every religion was articulated and propagated through a range of sects, each having the choice of being autonomous or being associated with another sect. These religious sects have a long history. Their survival is also in part conditioned by their closeness to particular castes or caste clusters. Nor is it unconnected with the patronage of royalty and the wealthy. This highlights the interface between religion and society, an aspect seldom given enough space in the concept of civilization. By bringing together virtually every religious articulation other than the Muslim and the Christian under the label of Hinduism, the extensive divergence as characteristic of religion in India with its unique qualities was denied. That Indian civilization was characterized by a singular and monolithic religion is unlikely. Dharma, which we take today to mean religion, was viewed as consisting of two streams. One was Vedic Brahmanism. This required a belief in Vedic and other deities. It maintained the sanctity of the Vedas authored by the gods and held that each mortal had an immortal soul. Strongly opposed to these beliefs were various groups jointly referred to as Shramanas, taken from the word Shramana meaning a monk, generally a Buddhist monk, who doubted or rejected deity and the immortal soul and treated the Vedas as authored by humans. Across the centuries, Dharma has been defined as the two streams of Brahmanism and Shramanism, of the Astika, the believers, and of the Nastika, the non-believers, which we today regard as the orthodox and the heterodox. The Nastika consisted of Buddhists, Jains, Ajivakas, and those of such persuasion, including the Charvaka, with their philosophy of materialism. Interestingly, in the initial social context of the Shramanic, the initial social context of the Shramanic rejection of Vedic Brahmanism was urban. It was in the second urbanization, the early centers of the Ganga plain that this debate took place. This dual division was referred to in the edicts of Ashok Maurya as Bamanam Samanam, in the account of Megasthenes, who talks about the two religions being Brahmanes and Sarmanes, as well as that of Huan Xiang, and right up until the time of Al-Biruni, a period of 1500 years. Patanjali, at the turn of the millennium AD, mentions it in his very famous grammar, the Mahabhashya, and adds that the relationship between the two is comparable to that of the snake and the mongoose. The Shramans in some Purans are called the great deceivers, Mahamoha, who deliberately misled people with the wrong doctrines. They are therefore Pashandas, frauds, according to the Hindu Purans. The Buddhists in their writings sometimes use the same epithet for the Brahmins. We are told that on some occasions the relationship between the two ended in violence. A deeper investigation of our history of religion may show us as being less tolerant and more violent than we claim to be. We can certainly take pride in the absence, so far at least, of an inquisition that forced people to make statements or to recant. But the degrees of intolerance and non-violence in the past need to be reassessed. Intermeshed with religion and society was social oppression and exclusion of those declared to be without caste or of the lowest status and polluting. In practice, this was universally observed by every religion in India, but it finds little mention in the ethical values and humanism of the concept of civilization. Our current highlighting of this we owe to the writings of Ambedkar and some of his predecessors. But let us not forget that the practice of social pollution negates ethical values and humanism. Yet, at a quite different level, there was a dialogue and much discussion between Brahmins and Shramans on philosophical questions, such as the definition and use of logic. By the mid-first millennium AD, the Shramans were also using Sanskrit in philosophical discourse. But of course, soon Buddhism was to fade out in most parts of India. The last 1,000 years, of which we've heard a great deal lately, the last 1,000 years have been quite striking in terms of the changes that were introduced at various levels in what we would regard as aspects of civilization. The landscape changed. Temples and mosques replaced Buddhist monasteries and stupas. Some of the most magnificent Hindu temples dedicated to divergent sectarian deities, and also the most magnificent Jain temples, were constructed in this period, 1,000 years ago. Very many of them only 600 or 700 years ago. These were endowed with land, and their committees of control were into substantial commerce, as had been the case with some of the Buddhist monasteries in earlier times. Economic enterprise, let us not forget, was open to all religious institutions and places of worship. Nor have these held back, since many have had substantial wealth to invest. The religion that we today refer to as Hinduism also had roots in the teachings of the Bhakti sects of this period. These encouraged new forms of worship and taught in the regional languages. In the transition from the Vedic to the Puranic religions and to Bhakti teaching, there was a distancing of the later from the earlier, acknowledged among some, though not all. For the majority of people, and I'm talking about the large majority of people living in India, Vedic belief and ritual, although patronized by royalty, became somewhat peripheral. It was largely irrelevant to many of the new religious sects that came up with new religious cults and bhakti teaching. Much of the teaching, attracting substantial numbers, was oral, since the larger numbers were not literate. The result was a multiplicity of sects of every kind, either drawing from or opposing the more formal religions. This receives less space in the classic description of religion in Indian civilization. What I'm suggesting is that the conventional description of what constitutes Indian civilization is partial. It does not sufficiently include the reality of the substantial contribution beyond that of the elites and the upper castes. The concept of civilization needs to draw from a far wider spectrum if it is to represent more than just the dominant cultures. This critique applies equally to descriptions of other civilizations. One could argue that the concept itself is therefore limited. Let me try and explain this. The compactness of civilization is in part because of its land-based and demarcated territory and the social origins of the cultures that it encapsulates. But many of the achievements resulted from the commingling of groups, elites and non-elites, both within this territory and those on its frontiers, and sometimes beyond. The commissioning of a monument or a cultural object may lie in the hands of a wealthy patron, but its creator is often a lower caste professional. Styles can therefore be a reflection of localities and popular trends, either of the elite or of others. Icons of the Buddha illustrate this. The Gandhara image from the northwest is Indo-Greco-Bactrian in style and in features. The one from Mathura is strikingly different, as is also the one from Amaravati in the south. It changes again in Borobudur and Angkor, Indonesia and Cambodia, and also in Dun Huang and Lumnen in Central Asia and China. The images do not conform to a single aesthetic, but do suggest the richness of the dialogues that must have taken place, unfortunately unrecorded, among those who were sculpting them. Surely some Shilpins and Sthapatis, artisans and craftsmen, also travelled with the traders, the Brahmins and the Buddhist monks to Southeast Asia in the early periods and to Central Asia to assist with constructional problems or the precision, if not the aesthetics, of iconography. How are forms transmitted to distant cultures? The idiom in a new context should surely be read in that context. The diversity points to the inspiration not being limited to a single elite source. Yet the creators of the icons find little space in discussions of civilization. How were the complexities of the Sanskrit manuals converted into visual forms by artisans not educated in Sanskrit? This is the interface that civilization is all about, not the separation of the two. Texts requiring scholarship traveled with Brahmins, Buddhist monks, and traders. Many ventured beyond the frontiers, creating innovative mixed cultures that would have challenged the existing civilizational models. This would be more marked in the formation of new states, and especially in distant lands. Some Indian texts were rendered into local languages and adjusted to local perspectives in an effort to imprint their own culture and to influence patronage. The variations speak volumes and need to be intensively studied. In the controversial additions to the Hikayat Seri Ram of Malaysia, this is the Malaysian version of the Ram story, the patriarch Adam of Adam and Eve fame, the patriarch Adam carries messages from Ravan to Allah. Other variations are similar to those known in India, but their statements remain outside the delineation of civilization. Adaptations provide another perspective. Why did the original Javanese version of the Ramayana story draw not on the Valmiki text, but on the narration of the story in the much later grammatical work, the Bhattikavya? The choice of one from amongst a diversity of sources needs explanation, especially now when there is an insistence on cultural singularity. Even if it's a transaction between high cultures, the cultural presence of the other is crucial to explanation. Central Asia provides parallels. The carriers of the cultures were the same, but the Buddhists drew greater attention. Buddhist monasteries marked the staging points of the trade routes that went from China through Central Asia and northern India to the Mediterranean. This is called the Old Silk Route. A healthy patronage encouraged each monastery to host murals of the highest quality, illustrating narratives from the Buddhist texts in the context of local history. Their versions become, in a sense, a commentary on the Indian texts, an attempt to see a part of India from the other side of the border. Do their perceptions confirm our current view of Indian civilization? The involvement of Indians in this trade through Central Asia continued until the last century. I was told in Leh that the caravans went out until 1952 to Khotan, and then they stopped. although in the later periods it was in segments because of historical changes. For over a millennium, this route had cut across what were identified as the separate civilizations of Asia, civilizations whose distinctiveness we have thought of as being crucial to their identity. But in each case, the achievements, be they in philosophy, religion, or the arts, drew on the interaction of these cultures rather than originating in isolation. The vanguard of the carriers of these cultures were traders. The rest followed after. Indians and Chinese in the past came to Southeast Asia through a maritime exploration. This linked up ports and hinterlands and required traversing the Arabian Sea, the Bay of Bengal, the South China Seas. It was an Indian Ocean route linking the segments of the chain from North Africa to South China. This is not a compact land mass, but the contacts it nurtured impacted civilizations. Like the Silk Route, it virtually created its own cultures. Was it a maritime civilization? It boasted of multiple cultures, high and low, literatures in various languages, architecture and art, that competed in quality with that of what we have called established civilizations. Above all, it demonstrated that ultimately knowledge advances when there is an exchange between those who in the know, irrespective of where they come from. This is superbly demonstrated in the study of astronomy and mathematics across Asia, dependent on this exchange for many centuries. This was not just a casual mixing of ideas. It involved the careful sifting of what goes into any knowledge system so as to understand it better. This surely is the more essential requirement of civilizations. The ascription of origin to a single author was not the point, nor was there a desperate competition to claim that one's own civilization got there first. When we start to think of the concept of civilization, not as something territorially compact and pertaining to a limited period of history, we will perhaps recognize the limitations of singularity and isolation in the current concept. We can either dispense with it, or we can redefine it. Redefining the concept will require that some existing ideas be unpacked and rejected, some repacked, and some replaced. Civilizations as we know them now tend to segregate rather than to integrate. Colonial conquests the world over with their new and precise boundaries ended existing interconnections between cultures. The best example is the links between India and Southeast Asia, for example, where different parts of India had links with different countries of Southeast Asia. Came the colonials, the British, the French, the Dutch, and the Spanish, and they cut up Southeast Asia into their colonies and completely eliminated the earlier communications. Cultural identities were reformulated with new hierarchies of status, both within a society and across its frontiers. This in part accounts for what are erroneously described as civilizational clashes. What is striking about the swathes of cultures that we study from the past is their porosity. Territories, languages, religions, however stable we would like them to be, are in fact constantly taking fresh shapes. The change comes from many sources: internal pressures that alter social hierarchies, alien cultures that accrete to them and take on new identities, diversities that transform even the cultures of the frontiers, and the ensuing perceptions that those beyond the frontiers have of us. Civilization is a process that evolves over a long period, mutating as it goes along. We have to recognize the mutations and discover their source. In focusing on the culture of the elite, the construction of civilization overlooked its dependence on the cultures of others as participants in the same society. The essential concerns with the why and the how of history did not find space in the concept. Overlooked in earlier histories, these can provide revelatory insights by forcing us to peel the layers and refrain from insisting that civilization is a uniform entity. Cultural articulations have to incorporate the dialogue between varying social groups in the societies that constitute the pairs. How did the participants in a civilization perceive themselves and their own activities and in relation to the social hierarchy? Did they all see themselves as one civilization? This is a tough question, but we may find answers if we're willing to inquire. If we choose to redefine the concept, can we think of civilization not as a self-contained, homogeneous entity valid for all time, but rather as a process of tracking cultures, even those perpetually in transition? The perceptions that this may provide can perhaps so translate the past as to give us a new understanding of both the present and the past. Thank you.